In our sermon today, we're going to talk a little bit about a movement in America that brought emotion back into religion and feeling back into faith. And our reading today is a reading that I think has a lot to do with how we Unitarian Universalists can be truly mystical, truly enraptured by faith and wonder and awe, even in the natural world. It is possible to be carried away by grace, even if the grace you experience doesn't come from a divine power, but from the mystery and the wonder of each blade of grass and each new day. So this reading, Awake by Linda Hogan, I invite you to listen and feel the experience of wonder and awe and praise, even from the most intellectual of persons. Waking today just before winter, when I try to name the color of grasses, how I feel their beauty, there is no word. I think of the time before there were words, when you would know morning mist by the feel of your loved one's skin and hair, and when someone came from the forest of dry leaves, you would know by their scent from where they came, even if they carried no wood. Or the heat of skin in summer, if they came the winding way down the mountain, they would be covered in cloud, returning to the fold. Or if they had gone further to the ocean, you'd know they had gone by their far-seeing eyes. And when some travelers return, they are shining with light. You know without saying, they have been in touch with other worlds and other mysteries. I have no wealth to speak of other than this, all this, just to praise the dry grasses and their color that cannot be spoken in words. So this is one in a sermon series. I try to do a sermon series every year, and it keeps getting harder to think of, you know, seven sermons on a similar topic I can preach and not get really boring. But I'm excited about this year's sermon series, and some of you have heard a couple of them already. The last one, I think, though it's hard to keep track, the last one was about our Puritan ancestors and the overall ethos of Puritan religion here in America and how, yes, it is even still a part of us here, we Unitarian Universalists. I mentioned how Puritans were puritanical, and that though a lot of gifts remain with us from their legacy, a lot of what comes down to us today from that tradition, especially in worship, is constraining and pretty cold. See, in the mid-1700s, when Puritan religion reigned supreme, especially in New England, only the wealthy landowners could actually be members of their churches. And only those willing to put up with some very, very boring worship ever came to church. The fact is that those settlers who came here to this new world, they were spreading out further and further across all the land that they had claimed. Parish churches were fewer and further in between, and all the way back in the mid-1700s, something was already happening that we're all too familiar with now. People weren't coming to church. Already at that point, like three generations after the first settlers had come to this new world, the vast majority of the population was actually unchurched, or at least not a member or an active participant in a formal religious community. That centralized authority that the churches tried to hold, it just didn't work over those vast distances and the elitism and the social controls of the Puritan establishment. It didn't jibe well with all the fresh energy that was becoming these new frontier settlements that would be America. People were bored. And here in the Virginia Piedmont, where we are now, the Anglicans were the most prevalent people on the religious scene. Ever since the charter at Jamestown, they were. But most people in Virginia at that time didn't go to church. In this place, at that time, that long ago, religion was something of a stoic activity. It was held between a person and their God. It was held quietly between the trappings of everyday life. And then it all changed. Like a consuming fire, it all changed. As a force moved over the land that nobody could have expected, leaving American religion forever altered. Beginning in 1679, that long ago, fires of religious revival swept over the American colonies. It started in the Puritan settlements up in eastern Massachusetts, places like Northampton, Unitarian strongholds even today. It started up there where preachers like the famous Jonathan Edwards gave sermons that captured the minds and the hearts of listeners. Some of you will remember or recall Jonathan Edwards' most famous sermon. It's called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. So famous. It was like the most popular movie in the land. It was a movie that everybody went to see. People flocked unimaginable distances to come and hear this. And the images in that sermon were not necessarily theologically complex. They weren't teasing apart issues of the Bible. They weren't even really about central points of doctrine. In that sermon, Jonathan Edwards' central point was this. It was a picture almost too horrible to forget. The idea that each person is like a spider dangling by a thread above a fiery pit, hanging by almost nothing above the abyss, ready to fall forever if only God, who commanded it, just said the word. He wove a spell over the people that came to hear them. That sermon was like watching a horror movie. Or maybe like watching a car wreck, which everyone does in this area, watching a car wreck and not taking your eyes from it because you were transfixed by the horror, transfixed by the emotion, transfixed by the tiny thread of hope that you might be saved. The people flocked in droves. They rode wagons over vast distances and rough terrain. They flooded out of the churches and into nearby fields because no church could hold them. For the first time in those English colonies that would be America, people were so deeply, emotionally involved in their religion. They were carried away with fear and with love in such a way that it drove them to wild dancing, speaking in tongues, and in time, to snake handling and faith healing and all the practices that we are so familiar with in American religion today. The people gathered in unimaginable numbers, tears streaming down these sedate Puritan faces, people dancing in the fields, two generations of Puritan repression melting in the fierce heat of that revivalist fire. One great revivalist preacher, George Whitefield, he was said to have such a loud voice that he caused a conversion 3 miles from where he stood preaching. And that's not even the best of it. They said that his voice was so mellifluous and musical and full of power and emotion that just his pronunciation of the word Mesopotamia would send women into fits. Mesopotamia. It's not that jazzy, but it worked. This is what would be known as the first Great Awakening, the first and certainly most influential of the great American revival. Under this banner of revivalism, religion in America became overwhelmed with emotion. And in the context of the revival, a person felt their faith. They didn't think about it. They didn't assess it. They didn't rationalize it away or pull it apart to check its accuracy. They didn't debate it. They felt it in their guts, and it drove them to levels of wild abandon and irrationality that religion in America has, depending on your perspective, either never recovered from or never come down from. Gut-level terror and the embodied joy that gives rise to tears and dancing. Those two aspects of faith stood side by side in those revivalist congregations. And the old line Puritans, the churches as they came to be called the old light churches, kept filing into their white clapboard churches of the Puritan establishment. And here is the magnificent thing. Many of those old light churches, those stoic, reasonable, measured congregations, would, as fate would have it, be and become us, Unitarians. The opposition to the revivals was nowhere stronger than among our Unitarian forebears. It's not that surprising, really, is it? The leader of the old lights was the minister at what is now one of our own, the first church in Boston. His name was Charles Chauncey, and his great sermon, the sermon that he is known for all time as, and is written down in many Unitarian history books as a turning point in our faith, this sermon, I cannot even make it up, it was called Enthusiasm Described and Cautioned Against. He was against enthusiasm. And he said, in addition, that those revivalist preachers were only that successful because, after all, everybody's got one good sermon in them, and since they were itinerant, they could just keep trawling it back out week after week. The old lights led a movement in American religion against impassioned revivalism and in favor of a new approach to faith grounded in reason and influenced by great European Enlightenment thinkers of their time. These were the people who read the works of great Enlightenment thinkers alone in their studies while other folks were speaking in tongues. And these were the people who in time would come to be the first among American Unitarians. And you wonder why we are the way we are. We are proud that you don't have to check your mind at the door when you come into our sanctuaries. We are a thinking person's faith. We are a tradition grounded in reason, and we are at times so intellectual as to be sitting ducks for satire. And so, by way of illustration, allow me to share with you a very rare sermonic joke. I don't do this very often, but work with me. A convict on death row the night before his scheduled execution was visited by the prison warden. The warden, in talking with the condemned man, said, "Usually at this point, persons in your situation find a great deal of comfort in speaking with a member of the clergy. With that in mind, would you like me to call the prison chaplain to come visit with you?" "Well," said the convict, "I was raised Unitarian Universalist." "In that case," said the warden, "would you like me to call a math professor?" It's only funny because it's true. Nothing is that hilarious unless you see yourself in it. And though our intellectualism is a point of great pride for us, there are other ways in which it is deeply problematic. At least it is for me. In fact, when I first became a Unitarian Universalist, there were times when I thought I was too stupid to be among our number. I remember one time in particular, after I had already applied and been accepted to seminary, uprooted my life, and signed myself up to be a part of this thing for the long haul, I went to a Sunday service at a big urban UU congregation, which shall go unnamed. The sermon had something to do with gene splicing and the future of cloning and the complex interrelationship among some sort of something on the cellular level, and whether Unitarian Universalists were for this or not. I had no idea what they were talking about. In fact, There were at least a dozen enormous dictionary words I didn't even understand, and I could not possibly determine what my opinion on the matter of gene splicing was supposed to be because I could not follow the argument being posed. I ran out of that sanctuary in tears, and I vividly remember that I didn't get far before I had to sit down on a stoop and finish crying so that I could keep walking. If this is what we are, I thought. If this is what we are, so stuck in our heads that a person with a degree in theology can't follow what the heck is going on in a sermon because the words are too big, what am I doing as a part of this thing? And eventually I just decided that it was a bad sermon. And no sermon, no matter how bad, is worth getting that worked up about. And I went on with my business. But the concept that struck me down on the sidewalk that day strikes me down still. The concept of our identity as a rigidly intellectual group of thinkers is one I have never been and will never be comfortable with. The old lights of our Unitarian forebears too often made religion an intellectual exercise. They responded to the fires of revival with a slowly burning retreat into the recesses of the mind. One point led to another and another and another in this onslaught of pure intellect, and it eventually weighed down their sermons and their worship to the point that great Unitarian bard Ralph Waldo Emerson, he came in 1838 to declare that all the Unitarian preachers of his day were practicing what he called corpse-cold Unitarianism, dead to the world and devoid of all of life and its meaning. That's pretty sharp. Like I once did, Emerson heard some bad sermons, and his response was even more dramatic than mine. In his divinity school address, which is famous for his framing of Unitarian thought, he wrote words that our tradition will never forget. I quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson. "I once heard a preacher who sorely tempted me to say I would go to church no more. Men go, thought I, where they are wont to go, else no soul would enter a temple in that afternoon. A snowstorm was falling all around us. The snowstorm was real. The preacher merely spectral. And the eye felt the sad contrast in looking at him and then into the beautiful meteor of snow. He had lived in vain. He had not one word intimating that he had laughed or wept, was married or in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined. If he had ever lived or acted, we were not the wiser for it. The capital secret of his profession, namely to convert life into truth, he had not learned. Not one fact in all his experience had he yet imported into his doctrine. This man had plowed and planted and talked and bought and sold. He had read books. He had eaten and drunken. His head aches. His heart throbs. He smiles and suffers. Yet there was not a surmise, a hint in all the discourse that he had ever lived at all. It seemed strange that people should come to church. It seemed as if their houses were very unentertaining, that they should prefer this thoughtless clamor." That's not the review that you want to get when you wake up on Monday morning. But Emerson was getting at something that we still need to consider today. The old lights had gone too far. Emerson's stodgy old preacher with his complex biblical criticism, who didn't have a thing to say about real life, had a great deal in common with my $10 word scientific lecture posing as a sermon. They both went straight for the head and had nothing whatsoever to do with the heart. They both responded to the emotionalism and revivalism of their time by putting people right to sleep. Some people argue that today we are living in the burnt-over remnant of a fourth great awakening in American religion. That sometime in the 1970s, when people started leaving mainline Protestant denominations in droves choosing instead evangelical congregations whose preaching, like that of those first revivalists, is terrifying and emotional, is an indicator of an awakening at foot. As we speak, mainline denominations are shrinking, in some cases drastically, and we Unitarian Universalists are barely keeping a handhold on our relatively tiny scrap of the percentage of the total population. Then as now, people seek out meaning in ways that engage the head and the heart. Folks want a religious experience, not just a lecture. And the mainstream churches, including the old light of our ancestors, were once much too slow in responding. We'll talk a while later in another sermon about the rise in the popularity of evangelical churches. But the thing that merits saying here is that the churches founded in the fires of the Great Awakening are today some of the most emotionally riveting congregations in existence. Pentecostal churches, where one can still find folks speaking in tongues, and mass tent revivals where faith healings are almost as popular as they ever were. They are powerful. They are nothing if not compelling. And yes, they are also often emotionally manipulative. But then as now, people are driven into the heat and intensity of religious fervor to do and say things they wouldn't consciously choose. And yet there is religion on a gut level. Religion on a gut level that feeds a great deal of hunger. And here we stand, somewhere between the corpse-cold intellectualism that cripples the heart and the fiery rhetoric of the revivalist preacher that discounts the mind. Here we stand, somewhere between the heightened state of the Great Awakening and the interminable sleep of pure boredom. The Great Awakening happened because people needed to feel something, not just learn something in church, because people needed to laugh and cry and not be lectured at, and they found the revivalist preachers all too willing to oblige, many of whom told them a message that folks still hear, that they are dangling over the pit of hell by a thread, saved only by their adherence to a particular way of being faithful to the whim of a God who could only be described as vengeful. Our challenge is to say a different message, that we are not dangling over the pit, but on the edge of an infinite possibility. And our commitment is to find a way to say it that pulses with life and energy and joy. Our commitment and my job, which perhaps I need your help with, is to keep people awake while we tell them we are worthy of love and not damnation. Everybody wake up. See and feel and know the beauty of our message. For if we are too darn smart for our own good, the hunger of the people will go unmet. If we speak only to the head and not to the heart, our yearnings will go unfulfilled. But if we ourselves can be alive with energy and pulsing with hope, there is a way forward that can feed our spirits and challenge our minds. Wake up. What is it that your heart longs for?